Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Life Science Rundown. This is Nick Katman with the FDA Group. Before we jump into our discussion for today, just a little bit about the FDA Group. We help life science companies in the areas of quality assurance, regulatory affairs, clinical operations, commissioning, qualification, and validation, as well as manufacturing and engineering. We offer three different engagement models, which are consulting, staff augmentation, and full-time employee recruitment. So if you ever find yourself in need, just head over to thefdagroup.com and check us out and get in touch. So today I am speaking with Cheryl Blasey. How are you, Cheryl?
I'm excellent. Thank you, Nick, for having me here today.
You got it. So the topic for today is courageous leadership to reinvent our healthcare system. That's a very big topic. So before we jump into that galaxy, could you introduce yourself and your background?
Certainly. So I'm going to start with my current calling. My current calling is as an advocate and a community change agent in the sector of healthcare. Prior to that, I'm a 21-year veteran of the biotech industry. So I've worked across four different companies from startup to large multinational company. And I've had roles in the science areas as well as team leadership. And I've most recently left the executive ranks as the head of quality and compliance. So all around the scientific areas of the drugs that are marketed and sold here in the United States and across the globe.
Thank you. So obviously you're moving into not even a different chapter in your life, but probably a different book. So maybe you could kind of fill that gap from your 21 years of experience to where you're going now, and then we can kind of jump into the topic as a whole.
Certainly. I think it actually is a very personal story about how I was turned in this direction. So I actually experienced a pretty life-altering illness, multiple chemical sensitivities, which actually led to rheumatoid arthritis, very serious. And I incidentally thought my life was pretty much over. Had a healthcare team of 12 doctors, and I was told that there was nothing that they could do for me, which was pretty disturbing because I think at the time the diagnosis came in, I was 48 years old. In the prime of my career, I couldn't leave my house, couldn't get out of bed some mornings. And so I started looking into other forms of healthcare, other health options. And what I found in that search, which actually now I'm happy to say I'm in a completely different place in my life, but finding those alternative options are actually what was able to help me achieve moving on past those diagnoses. And so turning into the healthcare industry is really about trying to help other people find what will work for them rather than being dismissed by the healthcare industry as a whole.
The topic of today is courageous leadership. So if you could bridge another gap, how does courageous leadership apply to your personal story and what you're planning on doing?
Yeah. So I think courageous leadership, we all know what leadership is, right? It's the action of leading people. But I don't know that we all know what courageous is. I didn't. I had to look it up in the dictionary. And it's really bravery. It's really going in and tackling something that you see as a challenge and aren't really quite sure that you're going to be able to do, but you're going to do it anyway because it's the right thing to do. And I think right now, when I look at corporate leadership, I don't see a lot of that. I don't see it in our healthcare industry, people willing to stand up and say, no, this isn't right. We have to go this way. So for me, I've always been about, even in my biotech career, my managers will remember, I've always been about asking the questions, well, why not? What about, why isn't this possible? Let's make it possible, right? And so I think that's just part of me. And now because of this personal experience, I want everyone to understand that there are more options out there than just what your insurance is going to provide. And how do we help people find that? So yeah. Courageous leadership is what that's going to take in order to go up against Goliath.
Well, just as a side note, because you said courageous, being courageous is kind of bravery. In my household, my children have to go through different things. And at some point they'll say, you know, I'm scared, right? And I borrowed this from someone. I don't know where I got this anecdote, but it's impossible to be brave unless you're afraid.
Yes.
And that's kind of one of the things that I've used to kind of push my kids into the zone of discomfort is, mm-hmm. you know, the only way you could become brave is if you're afraid and you do it anyway.
Right. And I think the fear part, right? Fear is different than afraid. Fear stops you. Afraid is, I know that there are going to be challenges and I'm willing to take them on.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. So why don't you move into our current healthcare system and what type of leadership you think doesn't exist that needs to exist?
So our current healthcare system is set up to not provide individual solutions. Our current healthcare system, you go to your doctor, go to the emergency room, you walk in, you meet a panel, a checklist of symptoms, and then you get a diagnosis. The challenge with that system is that we are trained as physicians, right? Those physicians who are here, we're trained against things that are standardized for human. They're not standardized for one person. They're not for an 80 pound person or 180 pound person. It's one size fits all. Okay. So think of your Z-Pak, right? The zithromycin that you get five pills. How many people have been on the Zithromax pack and then found themselves needing another antibiotic at the end or getting sicker, right? So literally, the challenge we have is that we have a system that doesn't look as each individual person as a holistic organism.
Mm.
Okay, we were looked at as a body part. I'm a hand, I'm a foot, right? And so we need to have leadership in our healthcare that makes it known what are all of the options. Right. If you break your leg, you're going to want to go get an x-ray in traditional Western or allopathic medicine. If you have an autoimmune disease, do you really only want to be focused on a pharmaceutical product? Are there other holistic measures that look at you as an organism and say, you know what? Maybe that product is good for you today, but here's some other things you can try. And they're going to augment, right? So we look at vitamins, supplements, right? They're part of what we call alternative medicine, but they're held outside of our grasp in our current healthcare system. Okay. And so I would venture to say that bringing in a change where we welcome vitamins and supplements, we invite herbals, essential oils, chiropractic, massage, acupuncture. All of these things are alternative medicines that really help your body rejuvenate itself. And so we need to have a healthcare system that embraces all of it and assists patients in finding the best alternatives for them on a singular level.
Yeah.
And that's going to be courageous. Somebody courageous has to step in and lead that.
Well, I think that's the key word is courageous, because looking at this from an FDA perspective and just a pharmaceutical perspective, things that are generally regarded as safe, there's no advantage to doing clinical studies to prove things because they're widely accessible and therefore it can't be patented. So the only way for them to go into business and be successful is to, create medical devices, biologics, small and large molecules, that can address different health issues. And that, I think, is the crux where now all of those alternatives that you were talking about, they don't fit into that box. Now, we also know that if it's not approved by the FDA, and there's a medical claim, then you will be cited as selling an unapproved new drug. So how would you recommend that leadership address that challenge?
Yeah, I think that there's space for everything, right? Because what has been accomplished by the Affordable Care Act is to drive everybody into the space where you have to have insurance, okay? And what that's done is actually created healthcare as a privilege through accessibility, through availability, and through affordability, right? Okay, so that's where we are. And I think that because alternative medicine doesn't have, because first of all, because it's personalized, because it is a one solution, one person, and because there are no placebo-controlled trials, okay, it needs to be offered in a different way than as a regulated product, okay? So most of these therapies are not internalized like a device is. A lot of devices are internal. They're regulated in a different way, right? Pharmaceutical products, they're regulated in a different way. Some of these therapies are topical. Some of these therapies are emotional, right? They're just very different ways of doing this. So I think that there needs to be very careful thought about how to make the options available and not regulate them. Because I would venture to say, and again, having been in the biotech industry for 21 years, we're all human. There have been plenty of drugs that should not have been approved that we have recalled from the market for various reasons. So it kind of also suggests that our system of regulation may not necessarily be 100% correct all the time either. So again, I think that the courageous leadership, at least for now, needs to be bringing the level of awareness up, making these things available, and then letting the people decide. Because ultimately, it's our pocketbook. It's our wallet. It's our choice. Right now, we're not getting any of that choice.
So when I think about that, the typical process is I get sick. I go to my primary care physician and I've entered into the system, quote unquote. Right. How is what you're proposing going to be handled differently?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that there's two stages of illness. So the first stage of illness is before traditional medicine today gives you a diagnosis. So that's stage one. And stage one is maybe where you're feeling not so good, but you can't really pinpoint why. Right? You go to your doctor, you say, you know, I'm not really feeling good. I've got this intermittent cough. I've got this or that. Or the other doctor says, well, I'm not seeing anything. Right? That is actually the place where alternative therapies and alternative medicines play the best. Because if you can't get a lab test to tell you that there's something wrong, an allopathic traditional medicine doctor can't help you. A physician cannot help you. A physician can only help you when they can run a lab test, get a radiograph, get a CT scan, or get some sort of diagnostic to tell them what's wrong with you. Alternative medicine practitioners actually operate in a very different space where they're actually able to, call me crazy, they are actually able to talk to your body through things like kinesiology. We call it muscle testing, right? But if you've ever been to a chiropractor or a myofascial release chiropractor or a muscle testing chiropractor who practices kinesiology, these are all forms of kinesiology. They can actually ask your muscle, your body, a question, and your muscles will respond whether it's true or not. So your body can actually tell alternative practitioners the answer before a lab diagnostic reveals that your triglycerides are out of whack, right? So it's a fundamentally very different way of thinking about health, which again, I think goes back to your question is why it can't be regulated. I can't regulate my body, right, that way, like the FDA can regulate a drug.
Right. So you said the first step or stage would be, I don't feel completely right. I go to my primary care. They run some tests. They can identify what's wrong with me. Is that the pivotal point to where now this broader spectrum of therapies can be presented?
I think it is. I think in today's society, that is the one of the ways to introduce it. I also think for other, on the opposite end of the spectrum, where you have people who can't get a diagnosis, there's over 8,000 cases on crowdsourcing websites for medical diagnoses where people go, they can't get a diagnosis. They put their whole medical history out there and wait for someone to tell them what they have, right? Mm. So I think patients at either end of that spectrum, I think I've actually, you know, patients who have autism or ADHD, some of these mental health, behavioral health issues, those are also not very well controlled by pharmaceuticals, right? And so I think that there's a number of areas, autoimmune disease, particularly behavioral health, hotbed areas for where alternative therapies actually will play, could play a very significant role in reducing symptomology, and in some cases, they can actually cure the illness.
Now, if my point earlier about that pivotal point from I don't feel well, I go to my primary care, they don't have a diagnosis, how could the healthcare system go from that point to opening up other remedies that aren't FDA regulated?
One of the ways that I like to think about that is through local offices to help individuals, right? Kind of think about like your local insurance office of State Farm or Allstate. You go talk to your agent. They help you figure out what's good for you, right? You know, do you need this amount of liability or that? And so I see a place where we have local offices around the country. Obviously, there would still be the need for, you know, telemedicine or like tele Zoom calls, right, for people. But I think that the essence is the education. It's starting the education process because ironically, there's a recent Gallup poll, 68% of the people who were surveyed in that poll are already using alternative therapies. But the problem is, they're paying for it out of pocket. And because we have this insurance industry, they're like, well, why isn't insurance covering this, right? That's a whole nother topic about insurance and what that has kind of encouraged. So I see bringing this information to people in a very personal way at local levels. You know, it cannot be managed by the FDA. I think there should be a connection to the FDA so that it's a partnership. There is already an NIH branch that deals with this. It's there's NCCIH, and it's the National Collaboration for Complementary and Integrative Health. Right. So there is already a whole government agency who already deals with promoting all of these things. But again, it's kind of buried underneath, you know, the other architecture. Right. So the thing is alternative therapies, if they're put in the right place and given to people at the right time, they might not ever get to the point where they have a disease, where there's actually a pathology that would give them a diagnosis of cancer or rheumatoid arthritis or multiple sclerosis, right? Mm. So it's a prevention mechanism. It can be a prevention mechanism. And I think, again, that's one of the reasons right now why it's not on our mainstream healthcare options.
Mm.
Because of the crux that you mentioned earlier, which is, you know, if there's no incentive to develop a device or a new pharmaceutical product because no one needs it, why should we do that?
Mm. Yeah. And I hear your point about the local, I'll use the term advocates that can kind of promote awareness into alternative therapies. What are your thoughts in terms of bridging the gap between the undiagnosed to the advocate that can share that information?
That's a marketing campaign. So I've actually been working on the concept for these local offices. And the marketing campaign seeks to target women who are between the ages of 25 and 65. Women make 70% of the healthcare decisions in American households. They are also the ones who are going to be caring for a child, perhaps, who has autism or ADHD, or dealing with mental health stress themselves. Women are also the most likely to have autoimmune diseases. And so most of this is based on marketing campaigns for women who are dealing with themselves, children, other family members who are in the space of behavioral health and or autoimmune diseases that could benefit from these types of treatments. And then helping them, you know, once we can get them to contact us. And again, I envision working through a number of other people who are very prominent in this field. A number of other podcasts and venues to try to get the word out that we do have these local offices with advocates who are ready to help them find a local practitioner for what they need.
Mm. Now, these advocates, you mentioned there'd be a marketing campaign. So what I heard was these advocates would promote awareness into who they are, what they do, how they can help to the legacy healthcare system, in hopes that once an undiagnosed person, hasn't reached obviously a diagnosis and therefore can't get any help, that person would be passed off. What would the funding look like in order to create these advocates across the country? And how do you see that integrating with the insurance industry? Would it be something that they would frown upon, or would it be something that they could support through funding alternative medicines? Or do you think that they would support it because they would be promoting alternative medications that they themselves wouldn't have to fund and therefore wouldn't be spending their own money?
That one's a lot to unpack. Let me see if I can start that. So what's interesting is a lot of these alternative practitioners already exist. A lot of them are, we're kind of running in the shadows, actually, because of the way the laws are currently written today. So the advocates would actually have a number of functions. Part of these local chapters would be feeding up into a database. So we would have a database of vetted practitioners that we have already sent questionnaires to. We've already made sure that they practice and they adhere to a set of standards. And of course that they have a good personality. So you can think of these local offices kind of like matchmakers, right? They're looking at a patient and they're saying, okay, what practitioner would benefit them the most? And then looking at it also from a personality standpoint. Because I've been to doctors and I go, no, I don't want to work with you, right? So we want to avoid that. We want to make sure that the personalities of each match. Educating the patients on the pros and cons of what allopathic medicine is, what is this form of alternative medicine, and then helping them get to the choice that they need to make. Describing to them what the value of the alternative medicine is, even if it is not covered by insurance. Okay. So now I'm going to tackle the other part, which is I actually do have a plan to work with insurance companies to try to get alternative therapies into insurance companies, especially some of the more sophisticated ones. They're pretty expensive, right? And they're not covered by insurance. And then the other option as well is, I think all of us have like concierge nurses available to us through our health insurance, right? Or there's companies that United Health will contract with, or Aetna will contract with, and you call them and they have nurse concierge services. We know it as employee assistance programs, right? There's that bundle of packages. And so there are 17 companies like that, that offer those bundled services. And so I will be approaching all of those 17 companies as well to find out, hey, you've got nurse concierge for allopathic medicine. How about concierge advocates for alternative medicines, and start working that as part of the education as well to help people see that, hey, this is another option for you.
What do you think those beginning conversations are going to sound like?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think that the beginning conversations are going to sound something like, no. And it's going to, you know, again, so I suspect that it will be, you know, maybe 16 doors slammed first before I get to the 17th, and then I might have to go back, which is fine, because I think all of us, right, you and I, Nick, we know this. We know we need to hear something 7 times before we actually hear it, right? So I think a lot of it is also looking at the statistics from the Gallup polls, knowing that 58% of the people surveyed in the 2023 Gallup poll say, no, I don't want to take pharmaceutical products. I have a very negative view of, right? Or that 49% don't get the quality of care that they need, right? And so I think that by looking at how people in the United States respond to these polls and using that information to help people see in these insurance companies, especially these little bundled niche market area, right? What those services are. I think that there's a way to eventually break in with the right words and phrases and start the process. Yes, this is courageous leadership at its best, no doubt.
Yeah. The you made a good point, which actually is going to open up another question, which is I think the trust in the pharmaceutical industry has gone through some challenges. I think one that's highlighted is the way the COVID vaccinations were handled and the amount of information that was allowed into the public, the amount of the data that changed over time. And so there are certainly people that are being a bit more skeptical and critical about what they're being told. And I think that's healthy to an extent, right? There's a balance, because when I was younger, I thought everything was 100%, right? If doctor says, this is what you got, I said, of course, that's what I got. And right. This is what you need to take. Of course, that's what I need to take. Until you or your loved ones have run into a situation where it didn't work out. And then you realize that, you know, these people are capable of error. So with that said about allopathic medication, if I think about nutritional supplements, chiropractic, there's a lot of other types of non-Western remedies. I would say the skepticism there is greater than Western medicine. So how could that be overcome? And how is it possible to prevent any sort of erroneous information being presented to the patient?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's kind of funny, because I think, let's see, you know, again, there's more more Americans are using alternative therapies than they realize. Right. So again, if you are taking vitamins and supplements, and there's certain kinds of supplements, right? And there's all different sorts of things. And we know that people create things that they shouldn't be creating and putting them out there on the market. Right. And I think, again, that's part of the vetted database, is making sure that if somebody's coming through these local chapters, these local offices, that we have worked on vetting those doctors to make sure that they are not only providing quality services, but they're also providing quality products, right? So that, because again, I know from my personal standpoint, it was hard jumping into this area. I knew nothing about it. It was completely foreign to me. I walked into the office and I said, I don't trust you, prove me wrong. That was basically how it went down. And I guess that the thing is, the doctors and the practitioners, I'm going to answer it in two ways. The doctors and the practitioners work on a very different level, is what I've found. And I've met a lot of them. They work in a very different way. They work with our intuitive selves, which is very different than a diagnostic. It's not, and of course, we all know, you alluded to the COVID thing. We all know that there are things that are not absolute, right? Even when we think they are, they're not. And so I guess, you know, again, having people understand that nothing is 100% black and white, right? This is an opportunity to try something different. And again, I think that's why these advocates at these local offices are needed, is because not everybody's going to be willing to jump in with 2 feet. They might want to put their toe in. Right. And so finding the right treatment for the right person is important to giving them the comfort to actually take that leap and try whatever might be helpful for them.
Yeah.
I think that the other thing, though, Nick, is that there are going to be some people who aren't going to want to try. And that's fine. Right. And I think this goes back to the old Malcolm Gladwell book, right? The Tipping Point. And then we're already way above 13.8% of the United States population who are already using these therapies. The problem is they're not public. They're not endorsed. They're frowned upon. Okay. And so the proof is always in the pudding. You're always going to have your early adopters. You're always going to have your mid-stage and late adopters. And you're always going to have your, no, I'm sorry, that's not for me, adopters. Okay. The thing is I think that the proof is in the pudding, and the more apparent these therapies are in our mainstream way of living, whether it's advertised, whether it's through other people or they, you know, your friends and family, that is the way people are going to get comfortable with it. And so creating these local offices is the way to start the education process, give people the information that there are so many pages on the internet. How do you believe them? Right? So this is a safe way. Vetted practitioners, someone, a case manager for each patient that comes to us. There's a case manager that will work with them.
Yeah.
However long that they're under the chapter, right, to help them find their way.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I mentioned when I was younger, I just believed everything that I was told from physicians. And obviously, there's lots of research that goes into recommendations that they have. And I think that we've done better as a society about explaining some of the side effects and adverse events that people could experience when they, they take these medications. I think oftentimes you assume that an approved drug, that's kind of like a very outlier. I used to almost even think, oh, that was, something that happened to that one person, and so they have to report it. It's really not as prevalent as I imagine that it was. And very oftentimes it it's not necessarily below 1%. It could be 3%. And that's significant. So my point is that I think we as, you know, citizens and advocates for ourselves and our family have to accept the fact that there's an inherent level of risk in allopathic medicine and alternative medicines. There's inherent risk when I go on an airplane, I get in a car and I walk down the street.
Right.
And so nothing is 100% safe. And I think if we are always looking to the God, which is government, to say, look, we have everything completely under control. You just listen to us and we'll take care of you. So I think empowering people to understand that there's risks everywhere, and then you have to decide what your level of risk tolerance is to try allopathic or alternative medicines. Now, I know in academia, they can do research on all sorts of things and provide reports, right? Now, this is sounds like a contradictory statement, because what you're talking about is having advocates that can promote information to patients and educate them. What could happen, now this is all personalized, but what could happen is we start seeing some sort of trend among a certain patient population and a certain therapy. Have you thought about how to report that up? And is there a conflict between aggregated data and personalized medicine?
Okay. Yes. Actually, I'm reading this textbook right now. 800 pages full, chock full of complementary, integrative, and alternative therapies. And one of the things that and this was actually promoted by one of our, Coop, who was one of our surgeon generals a long time ago. He said that, you know, research is power because it's knowledge. And so there was a challenge issued, you know, in the course of some of his words, that we should be looking at creating the data for these alternative therapies and bringing it forward. Why shouldn't we do that? Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, yes, I actually do have part of the plan for these local offices is to start aggregating that data. We in the pharmaceutical industry would call them quality of life surveys. Okay. But we will develop and validate a survey to help us figure out that information, because yes, everything is so personal. Right? These standardized surveys that we have today aren't necessarily going to be the answer. And quality of life is about how you feel, right? I think about it in terms of mind, body, and spirit harmony. And that is a very different type of survey tool, right? Mm-hmm. And then yes, reporting that up. This is, and figuring out, well, where are we today? And then how do we measure progress over time? I will say already, even the multiple sclerosis, a lot of, if you go to the multiple sclerosis advocate group sites, you will see that they're already promoting alternative therapies. They're not necessarily promoting your standard care of MS drugs, right? Because there is it's not just about your physical well-being.
Mm.
It's also about how you emotionally approach the topics that are that you're struggling with, as well as your spirit.
Mm.
And I also think, just to take it one step further, I think that there does have to be an evaluation.
Mm.
I mean, I look at it at the national level, and I think of, we have to look at what is working in allopathic medicine, what isn't working in allopathic medicine, whether the insurance factors in there or not.
Mm.
Right? We should probably ask that question. We need to figure out what is appropriate. What is a good value? Patients can't afford going to the doctor anymore. Okay. So we need to do that assessment of what is going to be good. And then you're right. The power of decision must go back to the patient. It doesn't belong with the government. It doesn't belong with the insurance companies. We need to become our own advocates again We need to be able to understand what the options are, and then we need to select, and we shouldn't be penalized because it is covered by insurance or not. Right? Yeah. Because shockingly, I was reading of this in the Constitution, but shockingly or not, they don't talk about health in the Constitution of the United States, which means it's not something that should be governed. Right? And because I was trying to figure out, like, well, is healthcare a right or a privilege? And really, health is different than healthcare.
Yeah.
And so we need to, you know, again, so I think that at the government level, at the national level, and I'm trying to actually get in touch with some people at the national level to have these discussions. We need to separate health from healthcare. Health is a God-given right. And it's something that we should strive to always have and figure out what that means for us. Healthcare, whether it's allopathic or whether it's, you know, alternative, that should be available and it should not be limited and it should be our choosing.
Yeah.
To figure out what's going to work for us and our family.
Yeah. Yep. Now my in your description, you were talking about and we kind of did a few turns down that road. Wellness, I would say, generally speaking. So my father had multiple myeloma. And one of the things, and this is anecdotal, that I was really impressed with, he went to Dana-Farber in Boston, and it not only did they, it wasn't all about the cancer. It was about their emotional state. It was about their convenience. Mm-hmm. It was about eliminating confusion. And it even went outside of themselves. Mm-hmm. Part of the program at Dana-Farber includes their family members.
Right.
Right. And so, so I think it's empowering to understand it's not always just about curing a disease. It's about overall, and the term of what I'm trying to say, I think, is undefined, because is it health? Is it wellness? I guess wellness is probably the best thing, but there's so much that goes into that. So you've talked about your vision for the healthcare system and opening up these opportunities and having advocates to facilitate. And you know, at the beginning of the conversation, we were talking about courageous leadership, and then we really took a deep dive into, you know, what is it that we're actually talking about? So if we can come 360 degrees, I know what you're doing, and you've explained that here. What is your hope for people that are listening, whether they identify themselves as patients, which we all are, as physicians, caregivers, or anybody else inside and outside of the healthcare industry? What would you hope that they would, the big picture in terms of leadership, and if they believe in this movement, what they could do to promote it?
The number one takeaway that I want people to get is be your own advocate. You don't have to know the nuts and the bolts. None of us know everything. We go to the experts, right? We don't try to fix our car ourselves unless we know how to do it. We go to the car mechanic, right? So become your own advocate. Know where to go and how to get the information you need, regardless of which health system you want to pick. Know how to find that, okay? Mm-hmm. And don't be afraid to ask questions. I actually had, this is an anecdote from my life, I actually had a doctor tell my son that he was afraid of all the questions that I was asking him. Wow, you never have to worry about not having the healthcare you need because your mother knows how to ask questions and ask good ones, right? So that's what we all need to strive to do, is to sit there and ask questions until we get the answer that makes us whole.
Mm.
We, oh, yep, got it. I'm good. I can go on to the next thing now. So that's number one. I think for anyone who generally believes in this movement, ask questions. Find out why your insurance company doesn't cover it. I know that there's going to be a lot of physicians. I've already talked to a lot of physicians. I would love to, going on to the last question, which is what can they do about it? I would love to hear from people. This is going to be a ginormous effort. I cannot do this on my own. I know there is tons of people out there who want to see alternative medicine being an option and not being limited by our government. And so I'm working on building a coalition of people, like-minded. We need to open up these local chapters, and we need to start bringing this knowledge to people around the United States. And I'll just add one more thing on wellness. Wellness to me is a conglomerate. So if I've achieved health, 100% health in my body, and I've achieved 100% health in my mind, my emotional state, and I've achieved 100% health in my spirit, whatever that means for each person, then I have achieved wellness. So it is a journey. It doesn't happen overnight, and it takes dedication. And that's why we also need these local chapters staffed with people who have that passion. And we need doctors and practitioners, not just practitioners that practice alternative medicine. We are going to need to have physicians that believe that a person is a whole organism who practice allopathic medicine, because that can't go away. We have to have that. But what we have to figure out is how do we merge them?
Yep. And to your point about asking questions, there was a study done, and again, I'm going to be absent of all references, but there was a study done, and they were essentially, the point was, and this was specifically geared towards CEOs. So they essentially were trying to figure out if we're going to break CEOs into two groups, which is successful and unsuccessful. And if we were to boil it down to one thing that separates the two groups, what is it? And this study, whether it's conclusive or if it was done well or whatever, I don't know that. But the result, I think, makes sense, which is the successful CEOs listen to their gut. I think to your point, you should continue to ask questions until it feels right. I say, there's a little man that lives inside my stomach. And until he tells me that I'm ready to make a decision, then I'll continue to ask questions. So I think that's definitely a key takeaway. So before we wrap things up, if people want to reach out to you and ask questions or offer help, how can they contact you?
So you can contact me at my business email, which is CherylBlaseyConsulting@proton.me.
Okay, awesome. Well, thank you very much, Cheryl. This was fantastic. And for everybody listening, as always, if you find conversations like this valuable, please share it with a colleague or your professional network. If you haven't already, subscribe to get updates of new episodes at thefdagroup.com/podcast and follow the FDA Group on LinkedIn. If you'd like to connect about project or resource needs, head over to thefdagroup.com to get in touch, or feel free to connect with me personally on LinkedIn. So thanks everyone for tuning in. See you next time. And again, Cheryl, thank you so much.
Thank you, Nick.